Hi, I'm Lauren Gilger, co-host of the show, one of KJZZ's original productions. It's a program with news and features from across Phoenix and the state. You can find much more at theshow.kjzz.org. Here's today's episode. Good morning and welcome to the show here on KJZZ 91.5. In Phoenix, I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, a look at how much water AI uses and what it means for our water future. And the Poet Laureate of the Navajo Nation talks about the power of poetry and passing the torch. But first, it's time for the Friday Newscap and some voices from the news this week.
This is about security at the border and making sure that we're keeping criminal elements out of our communities.
If you're going to be a true partnership task force, you would engage your partners to the point of what's the operation? What are we doing on this? What's this really mean? What's the impact? What do I need to have?
I'm not opposed to diversity training, and I realize that there is prejudice in the world, but we just have to do it very carefully and make sure it's correctly done without a bias on one side or the other.
We are at that point. I mean, that is a crisis when a president violates a federal judge's order.
I cannot believe that we are sitting here debating the qualifications of a lifelong public servant in an attempt for the majority party to try to weaponize this moment against the governor.
This issue is too important to be politicized, and I am disheartened to see elected leaders dangle the security of you and your families so that they can go on a political power trip at your expense.
This morning, I am joined by two politicos from both sides of the aisle. We've got Doug Cole, Republican consultant with High Ground. Hi there, Doug.
Good morning, Lauren.
And we've got Sam Richard, a Democratic strategist with Consilium Consulting. Hi, Sam.
Good morning. Great
Thanks
to be here.
Thanks, you both, for coming in. I want to begin this morning at the border. We're watching what the new Trump administration calls mass deportations play out here and across the country, which is really, it seems, what most Arizona voters voted for last year. They knew that was coming. Also, we're seeing the Democrats kind of shift in this new political reality. And that was a good example this week from the governor. We saw the Democratic governor, Katie Hobbs, announce a new task force, Operation Desert Guardian. This creates a state partnership on combat cartels with the Trump administration. So it's sort of a partnership between the feds and the state. And Doug, I want to start with you on this one, because there are practical results of this we could talk about. But let's talk about the political calculation behind this first.
Sure. Well, we all know that especially here in Arizona, it's border. And then when you get finished talking about the border, you got to talk more about the border.
Yes.
So we have this new Operation Desert Guardian that the governor announced this week. And you know, she had disbanded Doug Ducey's task force back in 2023. And also for your listeners, there's also a fund that the legislature has funded all these years for border enforcement. I think there's like $23 million left in that right now.
Mm-hmm.
But this task force, when asked, she said, I'm going to focus on the four border counties. I'm going to focus on drug cartels. Because drug cartels is a safe space for her, because she's made it very clear she's not going to go for Trump going into schools, going into churches,
yeah.
and is not going to go for bounty hunters, which has been a topic of discussion here in the state legislature.
Yeah.
But going after drug cartels, because they're violent. They bring fentanyl across. They bring other bad drugs across. So that's a good space for her to go after the independent voter. Because she's not going to get the far right voter,
and she is thinking about re-election.
Re-election, and remember, the Cook Report has her as one of the two most vulnerable governors. So she has to occupy some space in the border debate. And going after the cartels, I think, is a very safe space for her. And I think that we had the Cochise County Sheriff Daniel was on the radio and in other media saying, applauding the governor for reaching out to him. And he's a far right Republican, reaching out to her and applauding her. So I think if you know, the proof's going to be in the pudding,
mm-hmm.
and to see what comes out of this. But you know, with her support of the Lake and Riley Act, the first bill that Trump signed in his second term here, along with our two senators, I think she's trying to thread the needle because the far left of her party is aghast by some of these things.
Right. So, Sam, let's talk to you about that because, right, we saw our two Democratic senators, Ruben Gallego and Mark Kelly, both vote for the Laken Riley Act as well. And I think Gallego was a co-sponsor of it.
He was, yeah.
I mean, so all the Democrats seem to be trying to thread the needle on this. Yeah. Will it work? Can you separate the border and border security from immigration and people in your community?
Yeah. You know, Lauren, I'm thinking back to a conversation that we had about 4 months ago before the election on this very topic. And I think one of the things that Doug mentioned was that this, you know, perhaps is maybe a look to the election that is 613 days away. Not that anybody's counting. But I think this posture has much more to do with the election that happened about 113 days ago, yeah, where voters in Arizona specifically, but really across the country, signaled that we can understand a difference between safety and security of the border to really define what our country is, and then an immigration policy that defines who our country is in terms of the humanity that we have for people who want to join the American way. And I think that that is really what the governor and her allies are really trying to chart that course. And I think that with the support of Republicans that Doug mentioned, like the Cochise County Sheriff, you're seeing that come to bear, right? This is slowly becoming a space where there is room for post-partisan solutions to a topic that really has for the last 30 to 40 years been deeply, deeply partisan.
Well, and it wasn't just, I should also mention, besides Sheriff Daniels down in Cochise County, the Director of Homeland Security, Trump's Director of Homeland Security, former South Dakota Governor Kristi Noem, tweeted immediately out praising Governor Hobbs for this new task force.
Yeah, yes. And I think that there will be a lot of agreement. And obviously we saw that, right? I think abortion is a hot button issue, right? But Prop 139 had roughly the same vote spread that Proposition 314, which was the border a ballot initiative, had. So I think that what we're seeing is really this maybe realignment or this re-understanding of a difference between the safety and security of defining what our country is and, you know, the care and the humanity that requires of defining who our country is.
Do you anticipate any backlash from the left, Sam?
I think that's already happened, for sure. But I think that we're at a moment right now where there's a lot of things for, the progressive left to focus on. And I think that that you're seeing, you know, the center left and the center right come together on really, you know, smart headed solutions on what the path forward looks like.
OK, let's move on to another big issue of the moment that the left is also probably angry about. DEI, right? Diversity, equity and inclusion, something of a third rail now in the Trump administration. They're ordering universities to stop race conscious and DEI based programs or, you know, at the threat of losing federal funding. We saw the University of Arizona. They've tweaked some things. They're making some moves toward getting rid of some DEI initiatives and language. Now, just yesterday, the state Senate voted to slash state funding to public universities and community colleges that teach DEI ideology. Doug, is this a popular issue with Republican voters? What do they think about this?
Absolutely. Yeah. This is a base issue for Republican voters. And the Trump administration and other leaders, such as our Senate President Warren Peterson, who sent a letter out to the universities a month ago on this exact same topic. And then we have the first day of President Trump's being in office. He puts out the executive order and really, really raises this issue to front and center. Why this is significant for public institutions such as the University of Arizona, because they get a lot of federal dollars.
Yeah.
The University of Arizona is the premier research institution here in the state of Arizona. It's a land-grant college. You get one land-grant college in every state. It's Arizona's land-grant college. So it sucks up a lot of federal funding. And we all know the University of Arizona has been having some funding issues here in the last 8 months to a year. So the new president is taking this very seriously and is taking President Peterson's letter seriously. He's taking the Trump administration's seriously. And of course, it's going to cause some backlash. Okay, but this is an institution of over 50,000 students, and we had a petition of what that was passed around that had 900 students out of the 1,500 that were on the initial petition. Mm. I don't think that's a big number. Working on campaigns, but this debate's going to continue, and I totally get what the new administration down in Tucson is doing.
What do you think, Sam? I mean, like, is there a calculation that these universities have to make? How do you anticipate the other major universities here having to respond to this?
Yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see what happens with the other community colleges and universities after kind of, you know, the U of A response continues to take shape. But I think one point that Doug said, I think, is absolutely right and something to point to. This is 100% like the red meat equivalent of that base issue right now on the anti-woke kind of mindset. But I think one of the reasons why the right is pushing so hard on it is the exact reason that Doug's talking about. There's only 1,500 people in a university that's just shy of 55,000 enrollment that doesn't count the, you know, maybe 5,000, 7,500 faculty and staff on top of that, that also had some signatures added to that list. So I think what you're seeing is really, you know, a lot of tired response to this anti-woke. And I think that there's really, the reality is that this university is not going away. It will always teach, the history and the future. And when you can't do either of those things without acknowledging either through a land acknowledgement or policies that represent how diverse reality is. So what we call it, how we approach it, I think is always going to change. And I think that we've seen that ever since the thieving 13th legislature of Arizona's territory granted the U of A their status. And I think that that's something that will be interesting to watch. But this is mostly noise and I think mostly about the money that's on the line for U of A's new president and the realities he's facing.
I want to turn now to the state legislature. One of the big stories going into this legislative session, which really isn't that far in yet, right, is this emboldened GOP majority that actually expanded their reach in both houses when many expected them to lose seats. But they still have to answer to or go around a Democratic governor, right? So let's just check in this week on how this is going. So this week we saw the GOP majority in the Senate reject one of Hobbs' nominees, Joan Servais, who in effect has been running the Department of Housing for some time now. They claim she has committed fraud, plagiarism. This got pretty ugly, Sam.
Yeah, it really did. And Joan is a dear, dear friend who has incredible talent that I think Arizona is missing out on for the next 2 to 6 years of Governor Hobbs' leadership. And I'm deeply saddened by that on a personal level. But I also think that really what this is about is Senator Hoffman not really understanding his role in this conversation. I think that, you know, you have, you know, a demonstrable track record that he might not really have a full grasp of what his role might be, right? He's under indictment for alleged, you know, being a so-called fake elector.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, Governor Hobbs, in her response to what happened on Wednesday, said, you know, if you want to be governor, come on. Like this is my job. I get to name who runs my agencies. These are my agencies.
Right. So it really is about the process, right? And then the GOP did change the process, Doug, a couple years ago when Hobbs took office and created this committee to vet her nominees, and things got pretty ugly.
Yeah. This is my 35th session of working down at the state capitol. I know it's hard to believe, but yes, they took the nominations process of advice and consent that's in the Constitution, and every state has this, and the federal government, they've taken it to another level. They created this special committee called the Committee on Director Nominations, the DNO Committee,
because historically,
what had happened before Hobbs became governor is if you were the ADOT director, you would be vetted in front of the Transportation Committee. If you were the director of Department of Economic Security, you'd be vetted in front of the Health and Human Services Committee.
Sure.
Now it all goes to this one committee that's headed by Jake Hoffman. So we thought that this had been, you know, there was lawsuits that came out of the 2023 session because you're only allowed to serve a year without being confirmed by the Senate. Most of the directors in the Hobbs administration are serving outside of that time limit right now.
She tried to get around it. Yeah.
Correct. She tried to get around it by changing their titles, and which Governor Symington did back in the early 90s, but not to the extent that the Hobbs administration done it. But there were lawsuits, and it must be noted that the Speaker and the President won those lawsuits. And then there was a negotiation on how this was going to move forward, and that some would step aside and others would be renominated for those. But that all that negotiation all seems to have fallen apart again.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it really has. And I think the overarching thing, or from a 30,000-foot view, I think it's really sending a chill amongst high-quality candidates that might be giving a second thought about whether or not this is what they want to put themselves and their families and their friends through in terms of this entire process. And there's a very long list of qualified people that are currently running our agencies, people like Director Elizabeth Thorson at ADOA or Director Karen Peters at DEQ, and the list goes on and on from there, that still have not yet had the opportunity to get confirmed with the Senate, but are doing the work of running our state agencies and really doing the work on behalf of the Arizona people. And do they really want to put their name forward? And this is a really, I think that is the scary question that I think a lot of people are asking themselves.
Right. So, Doug, like, what does this say about the way our government is functioning at this point?
Well, I always like to caution people, you know, having been doing this for over 3 decades, as I said earlier, what goes around comes around. And I, you know, you start making huge systemic changes like this can be very hard to undo in the future. So the both the executive and the legislative branch are fully within their lanes and powers of doing what they're doing. But it's really caused gridlock, and I agree with Sam. It's chased and will chase off in the future, if this doesn't turn back to how it used to be, will chase off highly qualified candidates. Government service, you don't make a lot of money in government service, okay? The government pensions are not what they used to be 20 years ago, okay? So this really is an act of love in life's mission for most of these people. And, you know, I've always, as President Trump gets to put his folks in the cabinet that he sees fit, so should a governor. I mean, that's elections have consequences. But there is an advice and consent. It's just what degree of advice and consent. And I think we've seen the pendulum swing way far towards a very strict interpretation of that by this DENO committee.
Yeah, without question.
There's another big example of this week. We're pretty much in the middle of like a standoff right now between the GOP leadership and the governor over funding for families with people with disabilities, right? Republican lawmakers have refused the governor's request to immediately approve additional funding for about 44,000 Arizonans with developmental disabilities who are in long-term care. Hobbs has said, you know, this is not about politics. We need to get this done. But isn't this seems like something they should be able to agree on. It seems like it's another procedural debate.
It absolutely is a procedural debate. There's some technical questions about who knew what when and why didn't certain folks alert other certain folks around this pending large bill that was going to come due. But I think perhaps folks at the legislature didn't understand that this might not be the fight that you want in terms of the community that's coming out to talk about this. There is no better advocate than a parent on behalf of a child. And that is who's been showing up to the Capitol every day. Doug and I have seen them. There was a big rally on Wednesday, and that was preceded by actions every day previous and every day since. This is an issue that will not go away until the parents are satisfied.
Listen, this is really, while this is a $122 million problem right now, and remember it all started because during COVID, the federal government using federal Medicaid dollars allowed the state to pay parents that are caregivers for the kids, and of course those federal dollars are pulled back. But that's not the big issue. The main event is when access is cut. Medicaid, our Medicaid program here in Arizona, which is at $2.6 billion, is the largest single item in the state, the $17 billion state budget. This is a small debate compared to what's going to happen when if the Congress continues their path towards cutting funds for access. That's going to be devastating to our rural hospitals and to Valleywise, which is our backstop hospital here in the Valley. So this debate over taking care of the most vulnerable in our state is going to be front and center in the months months ahead.
Foreshadowing to come.
Absolutely.
Let me turn to one more topic before we let you both go. Arizona Congressman Eli Crane, he's getting some notice from Elon Musk for his efforts to impeach a federal judge that blocked the Trump administration from accessing financial records as part of the Musk sort of DOGE cuts, Department of Government Efficiency. This is pretty norm-defying, I think we could call it, Sam.
Yeah, I think, you know, this is definitely something that is possible, right? We were talking a bit just off air that everything is impeachable. So this is something that could happen. But I think that Congressman Crane is going to find little support in Congress to actually move forward in this in any kind of meaningful way. This is not something that I think is going to actually break through because of the norms, right? We are a society that lives off of the three branches of government, and I think the entirety of our government system would be upended if we didn't have a strong judiciary. And I think that there's a lot of attention that bleeds through any type of partisan lens that is going to come to fore on that.
Is this bipartisan, though, Doug? Because we're hearing a lot of talk of constitutional crisis, like those three branches not balancing.
Well, that's the foundation of our republic is the three branches of government, and they bring checks on each other. But you got to go back and look at the history. Since the United States has been around, only 15 federal judges have been impeached. 15 and 200 so many years that our country's been, I can't do the math. I'm a liberal arts major. But anyway, and no one has been impeached. No federal judge has been impeached for rulings from the bench, mm-hmm. okay, over the rulings. It's been for fraud. It's been for sexual abuse and, things like that. Mm-hmm. But never because of how they ruled on the bench. And I think the last one was like in 2010. So it's been a long time. So – yeah, I Eli Crane, he's getting a lot of shout outs from Musk and from Magaland. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what he's going for because that is his base. And but it continues to whittle away at our checks and balances system of government where the judiciary opines on actions by the executive and whether in the legislative branch, whether laws that were passed are constitutional. That's how it should be. But as we all know, that's getting whittled away time and again. And this is another example of that.
Yeah. All right. We'll have to leave it there for today. Doug Cole with High Ground, Sam Richard with Consilium Consulting. Thank you both for being here.
Thank you.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Coming up, we'll hear about the evolution of Indigenous authors from the Navajo Nation's Poet Laureate. But first, artificial intelligence is growing in popularity, with users asking for its assistance with all kinds of tasks. But AI uses a lot of water, which is in increasingly short supply in places like Arizona. Sholei Ren is an associate professor of electrical and computer engineering at the University of California, Riverside, where he works on machine learning optimization and sustainability. He spoke with my co-host Mark Brody to talk through some of this, and they started with a broad question. What exactly is the relationship between AI and water usage?
Sure. So AI mainly uses water in two different ways. The first is cooling the data center facility. The second is for generating the electricity. The first part is for cooling the facility. Since data center uses a lot of energy for AI workloads, energy consumption turns into heat, which we just have to get rid of from the data center facility to prevent overheating. And this involves two stages. The first stage is just called server-level cooling, where we're going to move the heat from the server to the facility or to a heat exchanger. And this stage involves air cooling or liquid cooling, like immersion or direct-to-chip cooling. But this process doesn't really lose or consume water. The second stage is facility level cooling. So essentially, we have to move the heat from the facility to the outside environment. And typically, many data centers, including those operated by big tech companies, use water evaporation. So this is the direct water consumption. And some of the tech companies can consume over 20 billion liters of water each year. And this amount of water is equivalent to some major beverage companies' annual water consumption. So it's very different from the water withdrawal. So when we take a shower, we're going to be withdrawing a lot of water, but 90% of the water that we withdraw will be discharged and go back to the sewage immediately. So those are not considered as water consumption. So this is the first part of the water usage for AI, like it's essentially just cooling down the data center facility. The second part is the electricity generation. So if you use thermal power plants like coal or natural gas or nuclear, there will be a huge amount of water consumption as well.
So when you talk about potentially needing more water to cool things down on particularly hot days, I'm thinking about how Phoenix and Arizona are popular places for data centers because we tend not to have natural disasters. What we do have, though, are very hot days for a good part of the year. It seems like kind of a conundrum there.
Yes. So if you build data centers in Arizona, then probably you're going to be needing water, you know, for most of the year if you use water evaporation. But there is a technique called dry cooler. Essentially, you don't need any water at all. But the downside of this type of technique is there will be more energy consumption. And it turns out that it will be probably consuming even more water offsite. So overall, the impact on the water resources in Arizona, if you use dry cooler, could be even higher than using the water evaporation method.
Is there a way, or is it something that you know, the folks who are developing AI, like, is there an effort or is there a way to use less water? Because it doesn't seem like people are looking to use a whole lot of less AI.
I would say these tech companies are taking water issues more and more seriously. So, for example, they are trying to use recycled water instead of drinking water for on-site cooling. And they're also purifying the water a lot more than before. So essentially, this can increase the utilization of the water and reduce the water consumption from the on-site part. And for the offsite part, I think the most commonly used technique is to reducing the energy consumption, reducing the model size, and speed up the process. So this is the I think generally these are the techniques companies are using to reduce their environmental impact.
Okay. How good of a sense do we have of exactly how much water these systems are using?
This pretty much depends on the cooling technologies. If you're using cooling towers, I saw a research study for Arizona data centers. They demonstrated that during the summer days, it could use 9 liters of water for 1 kilowatt hour energy. So what does that number mean? It just, if you have like a medium-sized data center with about 20 to 50 megawatt, then you'd be needing like millions of gallons of water each day. So that's, I think that's quite a lot. And most of the water is actually drinking water.
Yeah, I mean, that would seem to be a really big problem, especially in a place like Arizona where water scarcity is a big issue.
Yeah.
Is it safe to say, or is it too much of a stretch, that as artificial intelligence continues to be used in more and more ways and maybe in more and more complex you know, ways, not just, you know, writing a paper, but, you know, making movies, for example, is it safe to say that that will only continue to use more and more water down the road?
I would say most of the researchers agree with this statement. So if you look at some tech companies' sustainability reports, they publicly acknowledge the connection of AI computing and the water consumption. So they say this water, this expansion of AI workloads is driving up their water consumption. And also last year, there was a report from the Department of Energy. And that report shows in 2028, just a few years down the road, the water consumption by the US data center directly will be doubling or even quadrupling the 2023 level. So I think that's a really fast increase, and mainly, and I would say actually primarily due to AI computing.
Does that lead you to think that going forward, new data centers might be located or built in places not in a desert, not like Arizona, not like Nevada, maybe not even in California, but in places where water scarcity isn't such a big concern?
Water is an important problem, but it's not, I think at this point, it's not on the top of their list when they choose data center locations. So I think we're still seeing data centers, more and more data centers being built in desert areas like Nevada and Arizona.
The lack of natural disaster is more important to them than the possibility of using too much water?
I would say so. I think this, on top of that, this cheaper land and cheaper electricity prices are also attractive for data center constructions.
Sure. Is there other computing technology coming down the pike that you think is going to add to this even further, like something beyond AI?
There was some studies about the Bitcoin mining, and that could potentially be increasing the water consumption a lot as well. Beyond that, I would say AI is a primary driver for data center water consumption.
Sholei Ren is an associate professor of electrical and computer engineering at UC Riverside. The Sun Punchers are a Phoenix band who describe their sound as a hybrid of Americana and Desert Soul. But they're also avid students of music history. As part of an ongoing residency at Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts, they've been presenting a series of shows with different musical themes. For a recent installment, the theme was murder ballads, songs that tell stories of crime and depravity. In spite of the horrific nature of these songs, they're some of the most enduring and compelling works in American music. Sun Punchers lead singer Betsy Gantz recently spoke with the show's Sam Dingman about why she finds them so fascinating.
You know, without romanticizing crime or sensationalizing crime, it was a form of communication and oral tradition. It told a story, and it typically deals with the consequences. And so it was a way of saying, this is something you don't do. Cautionary tale.
Kind of like somewhere between like a parable and a history lesson in song.
Yes. And nobody had, you know, phones, TVs, radios. And, you know, even in the early 1900s, they had ballads that were almost like a New York Post that were a little bit sensationalized, you know. And also to debunk the, I think, the romanticism around crimes of passion. Mm. You know, we have one from an artist called Amy Levere, who's wonderful. She wrote a song called Killing Him Didn't Make the Love Go Away. And those were the words that a woman said as the news crew, you know, captured her. She was being taken away by the police when she, you know, her husband was cheating on her.
She gave him everything that she had. Changed anything he said was bad. Love weighed on her heart like marble stone. Flash of a knife, he was gone. He said he would give her the sun and the moon. Now she has this 8x8 room. Killing him didn't make the love go away. Killing him didn't make the
It's a haunting song, and it does not play necessarily just like a straight cautionary tale. You get the sense a little bit, and I'm obviously inferring here that Amy understands every facet of the main character in that song's experience, the love that she still feels for her husband, but also the desire to do him harm. And I'm curious, is any of that true for you? Like, how did you go from knowing about the existence of these songs to wanting to play them and perform them and write them?
Well, you know, I've only written a draft of one, and it was it's from the perspective of a Black Widow spider.
Ooh, cool.
So it was more of a biological bent to it. But, you know, I just was curious as to how did it, you know, tap down cultural behavior. It's very interesting.
You know, in getting ready to talk to you, I was thinking about the first time I heard the song Long Black Veil.
Oh, now the scaffold is high. Eternity is near. She stood in the crowd and shed not a tear. Oh, sometimes at night when the cold winds moan in a long black veil, she cries over.
There was just something about it that I couldn't shake. I had just never heard a song that did what this song did, which was to tell this unbelievably tragic story about this wrongful death and this guy who's being hanged because he had been with his best friend's wife, and now she's in the crowd watching him die, and they can't, neither of them can say anything, and every night she cries over his bones, like,
yeah.
And that the melody was so, yeah, it's really intense, but it also felt like, I don't think I had words for this at the time I heard it, but it just felt so daring to make something beautiful out of something so hideous.
Yeah, and I think the juxtaposition of those two elements make it hard to turn away from. I mean, even the lyric of Long Black Veil, that slayer who ran looked a lot like me. You know, you kind of internalize some of it. Like, do I have it in me to be that violent? Huh. It's very interesting to consider that scary place.
Yeah. You know, it's so funny. I hadn't remembered this until you just said that. But one of the other concrete thoughts that I do remember having the first time I heard this song is, could I ever love somebody as much as this person in the song who's being hanged loves the woman in the crowd? Because he's willing to die rather than impugn her honor. And
right.
I remember thinking, like, what a love, you know?
Yeah. And honor and virtue were everything. And so that was quite a gesture, you would say.
Yeah.
My goodness. Yeah. But there's, you know, the folk murder ballad, but there's the pop murder ballad. What about Foster the People, you know, Pumped Up Kicks? That's,
oh yeah,
that, wow. That is heavy and scary, mm-hmm. You know. I think we collectively are trying to understand and trying to solve and trying to heal through the arts and music.
Yeah.
We're problem solvers by nature. We want to close that loop. We want to understand.
Yeah.
And so when we can understand, it's so confounding that we're drawn back to it to try to see, well, if I look at this again, maybe it'll make more sense. Have I grown as a person to understand this or not understand this? Or, yeah, do I understand more about the human condition?
Yeah. But what do you make of the fact that, I mean, I think it's a similarity between true crime podcasts and, like, I know people who listen to Serial once a year. It's something they go back mm-hmm. to almost like listening to a favorite album just because they like.
Yeah, or reading a book. Yeah, reading that book. Yep.
Yeah, yeah. And obviously, you know, we do that with our favorite songs. That's much mm-hmm. more common to do that with our favorite songs. You know, a lot of people are troubled by that idea, that there's this kind of morbid fixation on, like, I just want to be in that story again. I want to be in that song again. But from the way we're talking about it, it seems like, well, maybe there is value in that. Maybe there is value in sitting in communion with this thing that is so tempting otherwise to turn away from and not consider.
I agree with that. I do think it's, some of these songs are a mirror, like the Long Black Veil. I'll go back to that one lyric where it said, the boy that was running away looked a lot like me. Yeah. I think you'd throw on that suit and see if it fits. I think it's an exercise in imagination. It's confounding. And it's a good thing that you can't fully understand. I think that's the gift. You know?
Well, Betsy Gans is the lead singer and guitarist for the Sun Punchers, who are currently in residence at Scottsdale Center for the Performing Arts. Betsy, thank you so much.
Sam, thank you so much for your time.
Good morning. It is the show on KJZZ 91.5. I'm Lauren Gilger. Navajo culture is having something of a moment. Just look at young Navajo writers like Kinsale Drake or Amber McCrary publishing books and making waves, and influencers like Alana Yazzie popularizing Navajo food on her Instagram page as the Fancy Navajo. Well, all of them will be joining longtime Navajo poet Laura Tohi this weekend at the Blue Corn Festival, celebrating Navajo food, culture, and futures. Tohi is the poet laureate of the Navajo Nation, the tribe's first. She's published books of poetry, oral histories, even librettos for decades, often retelling 200 years of Navajo history, from boarding schools to the long walk at Fort Sumner to World War II's Navajo code talkers. I asked her recently about the scope of her work and the women coming up behind her. But first, she wanted to introduce herself in her native tongue.
Yat e Laura Tohi yinishiatsena bilinishle, purajitni bashishchin. My name is Laura Tohi. I am Sleepy Rock People Clan, born for the Bitterwater Clan people.
I wonder this because I've interviewed folks from the Navajo Nation before who have wanted to do that, to say that on air. What is the goal of that?
It's part of our protocol. We introduce ourselves to others so that we will know how we are related or not related. We always find someone is our relative.
So it's about community right off the bat.
Yes, it is.
So I wanted to start this conversation with a little bit about your body of work, looking at how you've kind of written in various forms about 200 years of Diné history and what your goal was in that. Like, was it about reclaiming history? Is it about documenting history from a Diné perspective?
I think it's a lot of things. I was fortunate that when I was about 10 or 12 years old, I knew I wanted to be a writer. I was growing up during the Vietnam era and many of the civil rights movements, the Black Panther movement, Brown Beret, American Indian movement. And I was influenced by that because I saw all around me the injustice and colonialism that had been part of my life. And I wanted to write about that. For a long time, I did not write anything because I didn't know what a poet was. I didn't know what poetry was. And I started to read other Native writers' work. At that time, there were very few, and that influenced me, and I started writing in secret. You know, I was like a closet poet, and it wasn't until later on that I started to share my work.
So I want to ask you about something you mentioned there, because you, as you're telling the story of how you became a poet, right, you mentioned that you listened to and read other Indigenous poets at the time. And I think that's so interesting because I'm guessing that a lot of the up-and-coming Navajo writers and Diné poets and things like that, who you will be at this festival with, right, would say the same thing about you.
Yeah. And being the Navajo Nation Poet Laureate, I'm out there.
Yeah.
So people will know my work. But I have been writing since the 1970s. So it's really gratifying for me to support younger and emerging writers now, because I know what it's like to be out there and try to push your work out there and to try to get published and to have, you know, those triumphs and disappointments and, you know, just to have people buy your work or come to your readings. You know, I've been through all that. And so I feel like now as a poet laureate, I feel like part of my responsibility is to help younger writers. And so I try to do that.
Yeah. So let me ask you about what's happening right now in the broader kind of writing world. And it feels like Navajo writers, other Indigenous writers, filmmakers, creatives, authors are having a moment. Like, there are more of them who are getting recognition. There's more of an interest in this genre or in this history or in this point of view. Do you feel that? Do you see it in bringing up some of those Navajo writers you mentioned?
Yes. I think this is a very exciting time for Native writers and poets, but also for musicians and artists, you know, who are contributing to their tribal culture, but also to American literature as well. I think that what's happening in the United States is our art is really coming of age and it's really exploding. There are lots of younger Native writers, a couple of the young women that are going to be at the Blue Corn Festival. Amber McCrary just published her first book. And then there's Kinsale Drake, who also has published a book, and she's her and a few of the other Navajo women started the Indian Girls Book Club and promoting books to give out to places like on the reservation where we don't have a lot of libraries. And sometimes you have to go a long distance just to get to a place where a library is or where, mm-hmm. you know, books are sold. Mm-hmm. So all of this is really exciting to see. We are, as Native peoples, are getting out there and showing who we are, our talent, our stories. And this is something that's really exciting for me because when I was growing up, we had none of those. There were very few Native writers at that time. And the only Native peoples I saw on television or in the movies were stereotypes. Mm-hmm. Being out in the larger world, there was nothing there that really was genuine and unique for us. All of that is changing. So it's very interesting to see what's happening now. Yeah. And I'm so happy that this is going on.
Let me ask you lastly, Laura, about what you think the effect of this all is, like this long scope of history, recent history, I guess, in terms of writers like you leading to the writers who are out today and what may come next. Like, do you think that poetry in particular, but writing and creativity and creating in general can really do something, like in an active way? What does it mean for this next generation and the one after that?
Well, from my own life, I can speak to the oral history book that I wrote, Code Talker Stories. Mm-hmm. The stories that appear in that are all told by the Code Talkers. My father was one of the Code Talkers, but he passed before I wrote the book.
Yeah.
These stories that we have as part of our history, our lives, is something that I think people are interested in now. People are very interested in who the Code Talkers were, what they did. And I think that's really something to see, that people are really interested in this history, this military history that helps save this country.
That is Laura Tohe, the Navajo Nation Poet Laureate and ASU Professor Emerita. She will be at the Blue Corn Festival this weekend. Laura, thank you so much for coming on the show. I appreciate it.
Thank you for inviting me.
All right, that's it for this Friday edition of the show. Be sure to join us on Monday morning with much more. For Mark Brody, I'm Lauren Gilger. Have a great weekend.